are backstage with Janice Ian and Richie Havens. Bill Russell?
And it feels very much like the 60s. Nobody's in control.
That's how we know we're having a good time.
But see, we thought somebody was in control. That's, you know, and that's what we were sort of up against the various
Nixon
powers. Well, yeah, they thought they were in control.
There you go.
And you said to Bill as we broke away for a moment, what, you want to know how come we survived?
Well, it seemed like that's where his question might have been going.
It really is two things. It's how, you know, how did you survive? How did in the long flow? Because you're now partaking in history in some very real senses. I mean, the 60s was a kind of magic time.
Yes, it was.
We were lucky.
Yeah, we were lucky.
Well, and the confluence. And I still, and a lot of people, I think, still have the sense that we aren't quite finished yet. And it seems to me that you have a piece of that with the work you both do.
Well, I don't know about from Richie's point of view. From my point of view, when I look at my contemporaries, and there's a reason that I try to work so much with Richie, because I have huge admiration for him. A lot of my contemporaries got tired and got beat up, got worn out, or just decided that they'd go for the buck and the nostalgia. And I think it's much more fun to do what we're doing, which is, you know, working with Ani DiFranco or Peter Gabriel and saying, okay, I don't know what I'm capable of still. I'm 50 years old, and what kind of envelope can I push? For Richie, he's been writing a lot more than I ever recall you writing. For me, I started taking guitar solos. But it's that continuing evolution that was part of the 60s when everybody wanted that. And now everybody's got kids and everybody's got cars and everybody's got mortgages but us.
Well, now is it?
Now. I do have to throw one thing in there, which is really interesting because basically in those times it really was a rebellion of a generation. And I think for the first time in the history of the world, because that generation eventually hooked up globally, the same generation.
Right.
And for the first time in the history of the world, an entire generation chose to express themselves about their social, where they lived. You know, and that was the most important thing, because, you know, when I went to school in the 40s into the 50s, history was probably one of my favorite things. And the reason was, it was the story about how we got to where we are at that point. And when I got to the Greenwich Village, I realized through music that history hasn't changed a great deal. Because those songs that I was hearing, the guy would say, well, this song was written in 1852, and
it's still applied.
And what he was talking about happened to a friend of mine the day before.
Right.
So there was something happening that I had to try to get to understand. And what it was, in the end, was that we are still becoming America. Mm. We've never been America.
This is a work,
ever.
A work in progress.
That's right. Ever. Until we get to the point where everyone accepts everybody as being an American, then we're not there yet. Now, I can tell you that from anywhere from, I would say, you know, clinically, 25 down, they have the biggest lesson in what America is supposed to be than any generation before that. What it's supposed to actually be. We fought for what it was supposed to actually be because they taught us this is what it's supposed to be.
Right, they taught us here's how life is supposed to be in America, and then we'd grow up and find out
it ain't.
It bore no resemblance, and we all forced the issue.
That's right.
We talked a lot about revolution in the 60s, particularly the late 60s, and I think, you know, certainly Vietnam got in the middle of that. The civil rights, when Martin Luther King was killed, something happened in civil rights. But they never
what happened
really,
to the soul of the world?
Well, I think that after King and the two Kennedys, too, everybody got the feeling that if you stuck your head out of the sand, you would be shot.
68 was a very bad year. But, you know, we talk about this revolution, and in some ways, it, you know, remarkable things happen. There's no absolutely no question about it, both with respect, particularly with civil rights, both for African Americans and for women.
For gay people.
And slowly, I think, lagging that, but there certainly was a great deal of progress made in civil rights. But it's not clear how whether we finished the revolution, what the result was, or is this, again, the ongoing process?
We'd be out of work if we finished the revolution.
No, that's true. That is true. But I'll tell you something else. What I think, really, is that it passed revolution to evolution.
Mm.
You see, because what happened here had to happen or else. It's one of those. It's if it didn't happen in a certain amount of time, this would be a country of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Completely.
We'd be the Balkans.
Yeah, we would be the Balkans. It's really true.
That's what John Lewis says. We would be fighting each other
in our own neighborhoods, which we're not.
And the South would have seceded, and California would have seceded. Yeah.
More or less ad nauseum talk about the fact that we live in a time of great change, and it always is interesting to me, not only where we're going, which has all kinds of wonderful flourishes available, but how do you get there? And it seems to me an awful lot of what we are now experiencing is just the coming of age of the 60s, that it had to start somewhere. I remember the 50s. Bill and I are both class one of the baby boom. It was awful.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
It was boring.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
The McCarthy was everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
The stench of the old.
Granny Kovacs.
It was not what it is now cracked up to be in a nostalgic way. Had, as you say, Mr. Havens, I think that had something not happened at that point,
we would have imploded.
Yes.
Well, you reap the whirlwind. But it seems to me in a lot of ways what we see now is very much the 60s trying to grow up. Now, sometimes all of those mortgages and second cars and kids stop people in their tracks.
But the interesting thing about that is that, and I think this is where our job is so cool, they still go to music to lead them. If you look at one of the reasons I think that change that happened in the 60s could be global, music led it and music united people. You had people of all races, of all backgrounds, of all countries who all knew the words to We Shall Overcome, say.
Yeah.
We couldn't have done that without media. The same thing is happening now. I was stunned by the reaction to Kurt Cobain's death. And yet, a lot of these people, like my nephews, he was their Dylan, you know. So as the tidal wave surges, the tidal wave of the music surges right along with it, leading it and amplifying it, and then commenting on it.
Yesterday we were doing our homework, which was just great when my homework is to sit down and listen to rock and roll. Let's see, Hardship Duty. But I was also listening to both of your current stuff. And in the course of, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours of just sitting back and stopping everything and just listening to the music, I found that I laughed and I cried and
good.
I frowned and all of my emotions. It was like you guys had this instrument and you were plucking all the strings.
Good.
And at the end of it, I said, we need to do more of this.
Yeah.
Listen to more music. Yeah.
Isn't that part of what you guys are about?
It is part of what I think giving voice is what it's about.
Mm.
You know, I think that rock and roll, as far as I'm concerned, was probably the biggest social phenomenon ever to hit the planet.
Since the guillotine.
Oh, yes.
The guillotine?
Yeah. And the telephone.
No, seriously. You know, talk about things that revolutionized.
Yes,
rock and
yes.
roll was revolutionary.
Yes, and it was so because basically, see now, interestingly enough, again, what may be missing in the picture of where we are, is the fact that the things that we were fighting for as teenagers in the 50s, I make a joke out of the fact that we had to write music in order to save ourselves as a generation.
What's
and
the joke?
The joke is that we actually had to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a joke, is what the joke
it's
is.
A joke, right?
is that it really isn't a joke. We actually had to do that. And I sort of give an example, like I say, you know, you can't imagine how bad it was. You can't. Now imagine this. We had to write stuff like this. And then I say, you know, and it was a hit. And here it goes. Dum 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 dum. It's a I play a little note and I go, no, 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 I'm not a juvenile delinquent. We had to sing those kinds of words. Now, what most people don't realize about the rock and roll phenomenon was there was only two things that we were actually looking for. One was to be on the radio and hear it. Just to hear it.
Yeah.
You know,
we didn't care
if we made any money. We just wanted to hear it. Which meant we were trying to get through the pipeline, you know. And the other part was that was that that we were writing about the world we were actually living in at the time, which I don't think happened before.
Mm-mm.
As a generation.
It was like the transition in the theater that was happening about 20 years before that, mm-hmm. from the Shakespearean model into the Ibsen model of realistic theater, where suddenly you could say that an American tragedy could be some American guy. You know, the death of a salesman, he mattered. Whereas up until then, it didn't matter unless you were a king or a queen or royalty.
Both of you are known for popularizing, I guess I'd say, interpreting Bob Dylan. And Dylan seems to come up in many of these conversations
as the weasel was the best writer.
Well,
I mean, we're all still looking to beat him.
Yeah, I think people, I think people loved the subliminal clarity, because it became clear inside of you. It was mm-hmm. not clear as a poem mm-hmm. what was being spoken about,
no.
if you just read it.
But it went through you and moved you.
When you heard these songs, you know what I learned about Bob Dylan? I call him the inclusionary writer. And the reason is because you could take one Bob Dylan song and you could listen to it and he'll name every character on the scene in it and tell you where they are right now and how bad off they are or how good off they are in one song. The most important thing I thought about him was that he also wrote songs that most people could never sing. And the reason is, not one sentence, every sentence was the entire story. So if you said that line in your mind and you tried to think of what the next line is, it had no relationship to the one before it, and it will not have any relationship to the one after it. So you actually had to remember every single story he wrote in that one song.
And that's what we all used to do. I mean, you would run out, you would buy the new Bob Dylan album because you knew that that was going to be the best writing you were going to hear. This is pre-Leonard Cohen being on the scene, pre-Joni mm-hmm. Mitchell being on the scene. And you would buy it, and you would sit there, and you would learn every song. Even if you didn't sing them, you'd learn them.
This is a powerful argument for the power of narrative, which, again, is what both of you do in your music.
And we'll do some more of that when we come back in just a moment. Janice Ian, Richie Havens, Bill Russell, and I. We'll all be right back. Don't go away.
Sound effects by Janice Ian.
Thank you so much.